Great. Good afternoon. With the homework I just returned, there are two remarks with things which occurred more frequently. The one is in the problem to show a bijection between two lattices. All of you showed the bijection, not all explicitly showed that this preserves the lattice properties. And to show those, so of course it is sufficient to show that inclusion is preserved. You don't need to do join and meet, even though these are separate operations in the lattice, but the lattice is, once you have inclusion preserved, and you know that both are lattices, and that's what was given as assumption, then you know that meet and join must be preserved because they are based on the inclusion property. The other thing is in problem, which one is it, the third or the fourth? I asked to show that a bound is tight for an estimate in Erdős-Góráda. And I realized I never defined this properly. What do we mean by a bound being tight? So, in this case, and that's not just here, this is essentially in any case, even outside combinatorics, where you have bounds. Typically, you have a bound which involves some parameters. And the question is this optimal? Is it as good as it goes? And, well, you do so by showing that you can't do better. But you need to show that you can't do better for any settings of at least one of the parameters. Because if you have, let's say, if you have two estimates, one would be linear, one would be quadratic, and you're just testing here, and you have the quadratic, that doesn't guarantee you that you are optimal. Right, you might be at the, if the real answer is linear, you have the quadratic. In this case, well, here it would happen to work out. But what you want to do is, you want to show that it never. Well, actually, then this can't be right if this is lower. But let's assume we are only here. It might happen to work out in one place. But for other values of the parameter, it might not. That the simply a formula of a completely different type would give a better estimate. But if you show this for an arbitrary value of the parameter, then you know, there can't be a better formula because really the value which is attained by your estimate is a value which is a real result. So, in a few cases, you gave me examples for a specific value of n, and there I made a small remark to general n, and that's the reason behind it. Okay, since it's Wednesday, new homework. There was a request to have more concrete problems, and since at the moment we can do so, and there will be later again more theoretical problems, I've tried to pick more concrete ones this time. First one is to find a system of distinct representatives in one case, and probably the easiest way to do so is to look at this as a bipartite matching problem where the one side are the numbers, the other side are the sets. You connect when a point lies in the set and you try to find a maximum matching. Maximum in the sense, well, you want to have a matching where every point is matched. Problem 45 is about the Gale-Shapley algorithm, stable matching. So this is a situation, I think this is a minimal possible size example, where we have two sets of objects which are matched against each other, where we have individual preference lists. We want to make the matching stable. And the way I describe this algorithm, there is one of the parties chooses first, and then the second party reacts. And you can switch the role of the parties. and that will give you different results for stable matchings, and that's what should happen in this example. Problem 46 is a, since we had bipartite graphs, is an easy characterization of bipartite graphs. And then bipartition is uniquely determined. You could have a situation where you could make the bipartite sets differently. For example, if your graph is disconnected, right? If you have three vertices without any connection, or we could even make a connection, you just know these two have to be in different parts, but you could put this in either part. So in which case is the bipartition determined uniquely? And 47, 48, and 49 will be... Did I make that many? Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Yeah, I guess I did. Are about max flow in networks, which is the next topic we're going to start today. Well, we started very briefly on Monday, but that doesn't really count. So, before starting, are there questions? Yes?
For things like 49, do you have to do it by hand, or do you use a computer to do it for us?
If in a concrete calculation, I mean, you're welcome to use a computer if it doesn't render the problem trivial.
Okay.
So.
So no Mathematica. But
it depends how you're using Mathematica.
Okay.
So if it is, here is the software which solves this problem. I put it in and it tells me this is the answer. Computer says yes, it's true. That's not a good answer.
Yeah.
If it is, now there are, we need to, we, now we are testing 50,000 different permutations, and I did this with a computer, and that tells me this one is the best. That's fine. Then there is still some thought, and what the computer does is really nothing intelligent. What we will do is basically for this particular problem, I will show you a way how one can solve these problems, and the hope is that you would use something like that to go through. And I know these practical problems sometimes are more work to do than the proof problems. It's to have some variety and choice. Okay, other questions? No? So, flow in networks. And I mentioned, I finished last time with a definition. So, that's where the error is. A network is a directed graph where we have capacities on the edges. And I will basically, apart from one homework problem later on, I will assume that the weights are rational. Well, actually, I will assume the weights are integers. So a network, this is a digraph, which has vertices and edges and a weight function, which go from the edges to the non-negative rational numbers. Well, if we have rational numbers, we can scale the whole thing up. We can scale the whole thing up to kill all denominators, and then de facto we would have non-negative integers. And that's actually crucial for the way how I'm going to look at this problem. I'm going to look at this as a discrete problem. If you want to have it real, then well, initially the problem changes its flavor a little bit. Actually, in problem 48, you will show that it isn't really practically a different problem. You could round down. If you round to a suitably close, you would basically end up with the same result. But if you allow real numbers and you don't make particular assumptions. And this problem 40, in the homework problem 48, it's just showing that one can round. It's not giving an estimate how good you have to round, because that is much, much harder to do. Then you can get into situations where the approach in this way does not work, and one basically would need to translate it to what they call a linear programming problem. That's a linear optimization problem. But yeah, that is in practice, of course, you can assume anything in the real world is a rational number, and so that isn't really a restriction. So we have this network with weights. So for example, we have two designated vertices. The source and the target, which I will denote by S and T, and its target, so the letters are subsequent in the vertices. So for example, I could have a source here, I have the target here, and now let's make it a digraph. Capacity 3, capacity 5, capacity 17, capacity 2, capacity 9, capacity 20, capacity 2, and capacity 5. Something, some numbers. And the way you should imagine this is, say, these are pipes, this is the capacity related to the diameter of the pipe, it's the number of units, it's the units per time unit of liquid which will pass through some section of the pipe. And we are looking at, and we want to transport maximum amount from here to here, and we are looking at this as a continuous problem. So it's not that we have initially that we have 20 gallons of water here which we want to transport there, but we want to transport water all the time, and we want to see how much water is transported in a continuous setting per time unit. So that's a network. Right. So next comes what we will call a flow. What is a flow in the network? A flow is, well, some amount of, say, liquid which flows through this network and satisfies the conditions which are set. So a flow is a function f which goes from the edges to the non-negative rational numbers. And we want to have two properties. Well, or let me first give you an example and then describe the properties. Let's say I'm flowing with two here, I'm flowing with two here, with two here, and I'm flowing with two here, or let's make it three here, and again three, and again three. That would be a flow. And I could even increase this to three, make a flow of one here, and increase this to four. So, what do I want? I want that through no pipe am I pushing more than the capacity. Oh, and I set the weights here, I call them W. Actually, the weights I will call C for capacity. So what I want is the flow on any edge is not larger than the capacity of this edge. Well, otherwise I wouldn't need wouldn't have had bothered with the capacities, then I'm solving a different problem. So that's the first property. I won't try to push through more than actually will fit. The second thing is what in physics are called the Kirchhoff rules. I cannot create liquid nor destroy liquid anywhere within the network. What comes in must come out. So, how do I want to describe this? Well, this won't fit in that row, so let's put property 2 here. I didn't define this. So I need to define, let's put that here. I will need to define one further notation. If I have an edge goes from some vertex to some other vertex, so I want to describe the initial vertex and the terminal vertex of an edge. If an edge is the pair of vertices AB, ordered pair because it's directed graph, then I of E is A and tau of E is B. It's just a notation to get from an edge back to the two parts. So what is what is the Kirchhoff law condition? If I go for some particular vertex, for all vertices in V, apart from source and target, I have from at the source, obviously, I create as much as I want. At the target, I can absorb as much as I want. But at any other vertex, I have that the sum over those edges, that the initial point of the edge is this vertex over the flow of this edge, is the same as the sum over all edges, such that the terminal vertex of this edge is the particular vertex over the flow of this edge. What flows in that vertex, right? These are the edges which terminate at that vertex. How much I flow in is as much as I flow out, and I hope this is satisfied here. Here I'm flowing 3 in and I'm flowing 2 plus 1 out. Here I'm flowing 3 plus 1, 4 in and I'm flowing 4 out, 2 in, 2 out, 3 in, 3 out. Yeah. So that's the condition for a flow. And that's just modeling, yes, what would it mean to transport material through there? Okay, next, and there are at the start, there are a couple of definitions just to describe what we're doing. They are not hard, they're just because so far we don't have language for some of these concepts. So, what is the value of a flow? The value of a flow is the sum over the flow in the edges which start at the source minus the flow over those edges which terminate at the source, right? I could in principle also have edges which go back here, and I could have flow over these edges, so it's the net outflow from the source. Because of this condition here, it is not hard to show that instead I could have taken the inflow to the target. That has to be the same. And we'll see later that indeed that has to be the case. Okay, so that's the flow. And the obvious question which we are asking is, what is, if I have a network, what is the maximal flow through that network?
for this example, it would be like the sum of all of those middle ones, those middle edges.
Why?
Oh,
what was the question?
That was an S. I thought that was okay. I was thinking that was the T. Never mind.
And the min cut goes to the first two, the ones that you're connecting to the source.
So, your question, your confusion is resolved.
Yeah.
So, what we want, what we ask, given a particular network, what is the maximal flow possible through that network? And there is one observation, that is, if we somewhere draw a line which separates source and target, there will be some amount flowing through that line. Right? And that amount will be exactly the amount of the flow. So, because continuously the stuff moves through, so for example, if I take a draw the line here, I'm flowing 2 plus 1 plus 3, which is 6 through. Or I could draw a line here, 2 plus 4 is 6. Or I could draw it here, 2 plus 1 plus 3 is 6. Or 3 plus 3 is 6, and so on. So, in particular here at the start, I can measure, and that's basically the argument, this argument that it doesn't matter whether I do it at the source or at the target. Here I'm flowing 6 out, here I'm flowing 6 in. So it is convenient to look at this idea. Edges, something, some way where edges are crossing through, and that's what we will call a cut. Well, because edges which are going through is slightly awkward to define, we will actually look at the vertices in this cut. So, a cut, C is a subset of the vertices such that the source is in the cut and the target is not in the cut. We could theoretically have some weird cut. We could have a cut which is S and this vertex here. That would satisfy the definition. We will not have these cases in practice, but there is no need to exclude that, and just makes the definition easy. So, we have a cut, set of vertices which include the source and not the target, and so we have some vertices in there and other vertices not. And now I want to look at the edges which cross the cut. So, for example, if I take a cut here, I would have this edge, and this edge, they would cross the cut, right? They go out of the cut to the non-cut vertices. So, let C be a cut. Let's look at the edges which cross the cut. So the out edges of the cut, that are those edges where the initial vertex is in the cut and the terminal vertex of the edge is not in the cut. Right? These are the edges which are going out. This is this edge, this edge, this edge. Yes?
If we take the initial vertex
and then the vertex down below.
And if I took these two,
yeah,
then the out edges would be this edge, and this edge.
So doesn't it go over 6 then?
No, I'm not yet done.
Oh,
I'm not
okay.
yet. I haven't yet written. I've mentioned something informally. I haven't yet stated what the lemma is saying.
Okay.
And basically, there will be a second definition. Second part of the definition here. The in edges. The way I drew this cut, there is no edge which goes from outside the cut back into the cut. But in general, if I have an arbitrary cut, that could happen. Right? So I would have edges which go back from the vertices outside the cut to the vertices inside the cut. And these are not very surprising. The in edges, so these are those edges where the initial point is not in the cut and the terminal point is in the cut. Okay, and what I now claim is then for any valid flow, I have that the value of the flow is equal to the flow over those edges which leave the cut minus the flow over those edges which go back into the cut. And I think that is should resolve the counterexample which you were proposing. So if I take another cut, if I say take the cut of this vertex and this vertex, right? Then the outflow is 3 + 3 + 4, which is 10, and the inflow is 1 + 3, so I would take 10 - 4, which is 6, and that indeed is the value of this flow. In particular, once this lemma is proven, it is not hard to see that indeed here I could, instead of the source, take the, well, then I just would need to switch the rows of start and end vertex. I could do the same argument at the terminal vertex, because that is just a special case of a cut, and that would be another special case of a cut. All vertices but the terminal one. And that removes the unsymmetry from that definition. So what I claim, and I mentioned this so far informally, yes, if I draw whatever line, whatever cut I have, whatever virtual line I draw between source and target at every time unit, flow is what crosses that line. And it doesn't matter where I draw the line. And why doesn't it matter? Because of this rule that no material gets created or destroyed. So, well, that's the vague argument. Let's prove this. So, and I will prove this based on the number of vertices in the cut. And I will use induction. On the size of the cut. Well, the base case is that the size of the cut is 1. If the size of the cut is 1, I know what the cut must be, right? It can only be S, because S has to be in there. So this means in this case the cut is just the vertex S, and that statement is just the definition of the flow. So, now let's suppose our cut is larger. Let's suppose the cut is strictly larger than size 1. And what I will do is, then it must have some vertex which is not S. So let V be a vertex in the cut, and I don't want to take the starting vertex S. And then I could take that vertex away and still have a cut. D is the cut without that particular vertex V. And that cut is smaller, so by definition, not by definition, by induction, the theorem holds for this cut D. You look skeptical?
No.
No? Okay. So, what is my situation? Maybe make a picture somewhat. Do I need this? Yes, I can. This is one of these careless moments where you just erase everything thinking you never need it again and then spend the next hours reconstructing what you destroyed. So, what do we have in the network? We have the cut. We have the starting vertex here. This is the cut D. I have another vertex, this particular vertex V, and I had the larger cut C. Okay, and then there are some edges which go around, and somewhere here is the target, and there are edges which are going along. Okay, and what I now basically want to show is that the theorem, if it holds for D, it will hold for C. So, what I need to do is, I need to see how do the edges where I'm summing over for C and for D, where do they differ? So, if I have an edge which leaves the cut C, and did not involve this vertex V, well, that edge will also leave D, right? They are harmless. Interesting are only the edges which involve V, because these edges will be of different roles. Some of them will be only will be edges where I need to care for the cut C, others I need to care for the cut D, and the edges could go in either direction. And therefore, I will now define 6 sets of edges, those going from D to V, those going from V outside C, and so on. Okay. So, that's the wrong color. So, now, we consider the following edges. They're called PQR because they're of 3 different classes, and PQ and R were letters which we haven't yet used. O stands for out, I stands for in. So, P out are those edges where the initial vertex is in D and the terminal vertex is not in C. So these are edges which would go like this. That is P, and PO are the edges which go out, and similarly I look at edges PI are those edges. Well, you could have pink. Yeah, but it's not really pink. Are those edges where the initial vertex is not in C and the terminal vertex is in D? Okay, so that's the first class of edges. Those which leave D and end outside C. And they I would account for when doing this calculation for C or for D. Okay? Next, I will look at those edges which leave D going to V. And this set of edges I will call Q. So, Q out are those edges where the initial vertex of the edge lies in D and the terminal vertex of the edge is V, and Q in are those edges where the initial vertex is V and the terminal vertex lies in D. And finally, there is a third set of edges which I will denote by R. Blue for purple for R. These are the edges which go from V outside C. So R out are those edges where the initial vertex of the edge is V, the terminal vertex of the edge is outside C, and R in are those where the initial vertex of the edge is outside C and the terminal vertex of the edge is V. And what I now claim is that those edges which leave C are the edges in P0 together with R0. C in is P in together with R in, and D0, D out is P out together with Q out, and D in is P in together with Q in. And I think it is pretty obvious that these are disjoint sets of edges. No edge can be in two of these sets, because then it would have to be in two of these sets. Somehow there, the end vertices would have to satisfy contradictory conditions. And yeah, that's just, if I'm leaving C, either I'm already leaving D, or I'm leaving from V. That's the first row here. The second row is if I'm leaving D, either I'm also leaving C or I'm going to V, and that's the second row. It's the same for in. Okay, so. And now I want to I want to show that this identity holds. Well, I know that identity holds for D. Then the value of F is that its induction is the sum over those edges in D out flow over this edge minus the sum over the edges in DI flow over this edge. Okay. And now I'm splitting this up. Right? D out I can split into two parts, and D in I can split into two parts. And I want to somehow look at, I want to relate the Q things and the R things. Okay. But what is Q and R? Q and R is flow which involves this vertex V. And where can flow from the vertex V come or go? Either it connects to inside D, or it connects to outside C, because C and D just differ by this vertex V. So, let's look at Kirchhoff's rule for this vertex V. For the vertex V, what did Kirchhoff's rule say? What goes in is the same as what goes out. So, what goes in to V? That's the flow on the edges which go from V to V. So the edges which go from V to V is Q. So it's a sum over those edges in Q out, flow over this edge, and I have the edges which would go from outside C to V. That would be the edges in R in, flow over this edge is equal to, well, what leaves V, it's what leaves from V to inside D. So these are the edges in Q in, flow over this edge, plus the edges which go from V to outside C. These are the edges in R out, flow over this edge. Right? That's just the second condition for flow. It's the flow condition at vertex V. Okay. And what I can now do is I can bring both Q parts to the same side, and I can bring both R parts to the same side. Right? So, what can I conclude from this? This means that the sum over Q out minus the sum over R out Q in is the same as the sum over R out minus the sum over R in. Right? I'm subtracting Q in and I'm subtracting R in. So, what do I know about D out? D out was equal to P out union Q out. And D in was P in union Q in. So, I can split this sum into two parts. That is equal to the sum over those edges in P out, flow over this edge, minus the sum over the edges in P in, flow over this edge, plus the sum over the edges in Q out, flow over this edge, minus the sum over the edges in Q in, flow over this edge. Just splitting up this sum into parts. And now I'm observing what I have here is this. And that's equal, therefore equal to the sum. I could instead put the edges in R out and the edges in R in here. And then this is in total simply because now I can group together. I have P out and R out is C out, so it's the sum over the edges in C out minus the sum over the edges in C in, and that's exactly what we wanted to show. So that proves this lemma. So, regardless how we do the cut, and as I said, it doesn't matter there, while you might not want to look at this specifically, that the cut wouldn't need to be connected. Whatever cut you take, the value of the flow is how much leaves the cut minus how much goes back into the cut. Okay. So in particular, it means... No, sorry. Particular doesn't mean. That's just saying, regardless where I draw the separation line, what goes from here to here per time unit needs to cross that line. If it's a line which doesn't self-intersect or do something weird. Okay. Well, what I want to do is I want to maximize the flow which is possible. So, what I would need to do is this maximal flow would need to go across any cut. How can I maximize, if I have a particular cut, could I maximize, what would be the theoretically maximal possible flow out of this cut? Well, it would be the flow through any edge which goes out. We flow as much as we can and we don't flow anything back in. Right? So, what I have is definition, the capacity of the cut is the capacity of the cut C is the sum over those edges which leave the cut over the capacity of these edges. Okay. So, and what I had is from the previous lemma, the value of the flow would be for this cut the flow over the edges that leave the cut minus the flow over the edges which go back into the cut. And the flow cannot be bigger than the capacity. So what we have clearly, a value of any flow is bounded by the capacity of any cut for any cut C. So that's in some way, yes, the chain cannot be stronger than its strongest link, or this is the bottleneck, or if you look at the cut as a bottleneck or so, I cannot transport more through the network than the capacity of a cut. In particular, the maximal flow cannot be larger than the minimal cut. Okay. And given what we have done so far, it will not come as a surprise that both are the same. Okay. That requires, it's not a long proof, but that requires a proof. That is not automatically obviously true. Right? If you just imagine, I mean, that is trivial. That has to hold automatically because the value of the flow would be, this is bound by the capacities, I'm subtracting a non-negative number. So what I would have in the best of all cases, I have a cut of minimum capacity, would be that I'm not flowing anything back through that cut, that I'm only flowing out. But can I achieve this? Can I achieve to flow out the cut? Only out the cut, nothing back into the cut. Well, that's what the theorem says. Oh.
And that's what the clock says.
Yeah, so, well, I've given away the suspense for next time. So what we will see is the value, the maximum value of a flow is not just bounded by, but exactly given by the capacity of a minimum cut. And the proof, actually, with what we've done before, the proof will be very quick. And then we will see the more interesting question, how can we actually obtain such a flow? And that should remind you of what we've done with the bipartite graphs, the switching of edges. Yeah, thank you very much, and I'll see you on Friday.